From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with Vermont author Catherine Davis, who has a new memoir out with Grey Wolf Press, titled Aurelia Aurelia. Catherine Davis is the author of 6 novels. She has received the Kafka Prize, the Morton Dowen Zabel Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and the Lannan Foundation Literary Award. She teaches at Washington University and lives in Vermont and St. Louis, Missouri. You can find 3 of my previous interviews with Catherine on Write the Book's podcast site. Here's a little information about Aurelia Aurelia, which begins on a boat. The author, 16 years old, is traveling to Europe at an age when one can try on personae-like dresses, as she puts it. She has the confidence of a teenager cultivating her earliest obsessions, Wolf, Durrell, Bergman, sure of her maturity, sure of the life that awaits her. Soon she finds herself in a Greece far drearier than the Greece of fantasy, climbing up and down the steep paths every morning with the real old women looking for kindling. Aurelia Aurelia is a meditation on the way imagination shapes life and how life, as it moves forward, shapes imagination. At its center is the death of Catherine's husband, Eric. The book unfolds as a study of their marriage, its deep joys and stinging frustrations. It is also a book about time, the inexorable events that determine beginnings and endings. The preoccupations that mark Davis's fiction are recognizable here: fateful voyages, an intense sense of place, the unexpected union of the magical and the real. But the vehicle itself is utterly new. Slate has called Catherine Davis the most original novelist in America. When we spoke last week, I began by asking Catherine how the book came to be. A mutual friend of ours, Susan, had mentioned to me that the book was originally intended to be a craft book, so I asked Catherine about that as well. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, I started out writing, it was a craft book for Grey Wolf. They have a series called The Art Of, and I had spoken with Fiona McCrae, the editor-in-chief there, quite a few years ago about doing a craft book. I wanted to do it on the subject of transition, which is a very interesting subject to me in terms of my, in terms of life, of course, but also in terms of my writing, because I had realized that in a way, what passes for the energy that drives a narrative in almost everything I've ever written are a series of transitions. So there'll be a moment where you think you're here in a particular place, and then you jump, sometimes a big jump, sometimes a little jump, sometimes between paragraphs, but it's the way things move for me. It's the way I hear the motion in a piece of writing. And I wanted to write about that. And I thought I'd never written a craft book, and I had never in my life actually liked writing nonfiction. Even in high school, when I had to write an academic paper, I would try to get away with, turning it into a short story, something like that. So I started out, and right off, I had been asked by some people at a small literary magazine if I would like to contribute something. I can't remember if they suggested a topic, but I thought, I want to write about the time passes section of To the Lighthouse, which has always been, for me, my favorite part of To the Lighthouse, and is just pure transition. And so I began with that. And while I was writing that, it became clear to me that whenever I sort of took a sidestep away from the more academic approach to the topic and was putting in material out of my own life, which I normally don't do, writing fiction, I was really enjoying it. And I continued to notice that with subsequent chapters I wrote for the craft book, I would become most involved when I was making a connection between events in my own life and the more theoretical writing.
Right.
And then I wrote what is now the last chapter of the book. I didn't know what it was at the time. And it's the Aurelia chapter. And I had given it to my agent because I thought it was standalone. And I thought, you know, maybe she could sell it somewhere. And she called me back and said, you know, you're not writing a craft book. this is your book, and it's not as if you can't use quite a bit of what you've written, but this is something else completely different. And she was very excited, and kind of simultaneously, my friend Louise was saying exactly the same thing to me about that chapter. And because what they were saying made sense to me, even though it was a little discouraging to think that all the work I had already done was maybe not going to prove useful, I turned my attention to writing completely different other chapters that were more in keeping with what became the final chapter of the book. And then I got very excited by doing something which I thought I didn't want to do, which was, you know, write memoir.
Right. Now, at what point in the, you know, writing, before you understood what the book was going to become, at what point did Eric get sick, your husband Eric Cenci?
He was diagnosed with the cancer that ultimately did kill him. He was diagnosed with it back in 2005, I think. It was a long time ago. And I think it preceded the initial stages of writing the craft book. But at that point, we knew it was a serious diagnosis, but we didn't know what the course of the course the disease was going to take.
Right.
So,
well, it's interesting that this started out as a craft book about transitions, because I had so many questions about transitions. it's clearly appropriate for this to be a book that concerns transitions. And, you know, when you open the book, you open, first of all, also, I have to say, it sounds like really heavy material, but it's really wonderful. It's just this incredible interweaving of humor and hard stuff and beauty and an appreciation for literature. I really enjoyed how it all comes together. You open describing your 16-year-old self at, and the way that words have always meant so much to you. And you describe having read the Alexandria Quartet. I really enjoyed the irony of the fact that you loved but did not understand the words, which concerned a young woman's nature, which was gorged upon introspection. I'm sorry, I had to look this up because I have not read the Alexandria Quartet, but the author Durrell said his books were an exploration of relativity and the notions of continuum and subject-object relation, right? And I'm like, oh, well, these seem like big concerns for Catherine as well. And so obviously you didn't pluck that out of the sky as just a 16-year-old's memory or a memory from that point in your life.
Well, what really attracted me to the Alexandria Quartet, number one, it was a big reading project. There were four books. And I knew that it was adult material, not like, you know, X-rated necessarily, but that there were things going on in the Alexandria Quartet that were the matters of adulthood. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of sexual activity, although most of it was going on sort of behind the scenes, and there were unwanted pregnancies and sort of shocking things. And that I was very attracted to that, though I was about as innocent of those matters as a 16-year-old person could be. And the other thing that attracted me to the books was just the vocabulary he used, which now I read it and it drives me crazy. I think it sounds like he just sat there with a thesaurus paging through and using whatever words he could come up with. But at the time, to me, that it was the height of sophistication and adult reading. I felt like an adult reading it.
Yeah.
And I wrote him a fan letter.
Oh, yeah. Did you hear back?
No.
That's too bad. So late in the book, you write, "I've given death a lot of thought." And it's interesting. You just said you don't write about your life in your fiction, although I have always thought that you sort of included some of your life in your fiction. Duplex takes place in Philadelphia, and I think there's a lot of overlap to the way that you grew up and the neighborhood you grew up in, right?
I write about my life all the time. I mean, even when I was writing about Marie Antoinette in Versailles, I'm definitely writing about me in some way. But I've never come at it head on the way I did with this book, where I just say it's me. I was a 16-year-old girl using the first person as my very own self, as opposed to pretending to be, a French queen or
a Russian.
Or a Russian.
Okay, so your work sort of reflects your preoccupation with death, I think. Maybe it's not a preoccupation, but it's a consideration. You've given it a lot of thought. And I just wondered if we can talk a little bit about how you channel your preoccupations as you work. Do they tend to kind of bother you and make their way into your work, sort of like an itch that needs to be scratched? Or do you think it's more, does it look different than that? I'm just curious.
I think for me, When I am working, it's not as if I'm not thinking. I am thinking, but it's as if sort of all of who I am, I want to kind of, at my best when I'm writing, I feel as if the door opens and all of who I am, which can include somebody who has forgotten to put away something in the closet, as well as a person who's thinking about large issues having to do with the universe. I want the feeling I have writing to be the possibility that all of that is present. And things I've read, conversations I've had, so because I don't do much in the way of planning, I'm hoping, not to say again that it's not as if I have no plans whatsoever when I'm writing, but there's not very much that is hampering me when I sit down to work. So I don't feel like I'm particularly channeling any one thing or another thing or whatever I'm most interested in at the moment when I sit down to work, I want that thing to be emerging in what I write. And
all right. Yeah.
So with this book, I was pretty much focused in a way. I was once I gave up the idea that I was writing a craft book about transition, I was still focused on the fact that in my life, this very big transition had occurred where I had gone through the dying and death of my husband And we had, it was something we had done very much together. And I wanted as much of what that had meant to me to emerge in the writing mm-hmm. as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you move into, To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf, which, you focus on the section called Time Passes, and your chapter is also called Time Passes. And you mentioned that Time Passes begins with a series of what you call disembodied utterances, pronouncements, really, almost as if the speakers are speaking to themselves. And then, you know, as your work went on, I noticed that that became almost a sort of, and I feel like this is really on the nose, and I'm sorry about that, but it became almost sort of an important metaphor for how unprepared we are for life's transitions. And I, you know, in your case, transitions like Eric's illness and finding yourselves in the hospital and facing surgery and other options for how he was going to be treated. How did you look at the transitions as you were working on this book that included those sorts of moments in your life?
You mean as opposed to, say, the transitions in my life as I was living my life, as opposed to transitions occurring in the writing of something? Is that?
I feel like your writing reflected the kind of unexpected nature. Not all throughout, but in Time Passes, I felt like in a way you almost echoed some of her disembodied utterances and pronouncements a little bit, and it to me it sort of felt a lot like what you were writing about, which was the unexpected happening. Does
right.
that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does. And I mean, I think that living a life just anyway, and forgetting about things like the pandemic, which was quite an unexpected event. But it, just in the most daily way, to assume that you can expect things to go along according to a pattern, you sort of have to function as if there's some element of reliability about the passage of time, an event in a day. And yet we all know that that's not the way life happens. And when we're, and I feel like that sense of things has always been with me. I've always had this, I think it has something to do with my weird relationship to time, mm-hmm. I mean, it took me a really long time to learn how to read a clock when I was a kid, even
though
I'm
interesting.
Not stupid. And I think there's something about time that I feel like I exist in time in a way that's quite mysterious. And so that also, in terms of transition, affects the way I feel moving through just a regular day with, you know, a regular time frame, and that there are going to be things that occur that seem in a way out of joint, and yet that in its own way is expectable. And the big event of Eric's illness was just another larger instance of how you cannot know what life is going to offer up to you, but then you might as well just sort of you know, be on board, be part of this thing that rolls over you, that is life filled with the unexpected.
Right. I'm trying to remember. So this is actually, I was looking back. This is our fourth interview. We've talked about The Thin Place, Duplex, and The Silk Road before this. So I'm not remembering which book it is, but I know in one of your books, one of your characters makes the, I think, makes some sort of pronouncement about how the only way they can tell time is passing is because their eyesight is failing. Is that right? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was so great.
I think that might have been in the Silk Road, but I'm not positive.
I think it might have been. I think it's more recent than, yeah. It's definitely not The Thin Place, but okay. Now, you include a lot of references in the book, literary, cultural references from To the Lighthouse, to the show Lost, to Peter and the Wolf, and many others. So I'd like to talk about one moment when you're writing about Lost, the TV show Lost, but you're really writing about cancer, and you use an echoing sentence structure to make your point. Do you mind if I read it?
No, no.
So this is on, I forget what page, but it's on a page. A series like Lost, any television series meant to be watched over a period of time, involves built-in inevitable moments of transition, moments that can last as long or longer than a week between episodes, or as brief as the instant it takes a binge watcher to switch from one episode to the next. And then on the next page, I think, one or two pages later, this sentence happens. The thing about cancer, about any human malady that doesn't have a knowable cause, not like bubonic plague, say, or rabies, is that it seems bestowed haphazardly. The system governing its bestowal, as inscrutable as the system prevailing on the island. So I wonder if we can just talk, the fact is that the actual points that you're making about each of those things, the series Lost and cancer. The fact is you make your actual point better in the sentences that follow, but the way that those two sentences sort of echo each other, and if one looks at the page, you actually see that they look a lot alike too, because there's a dash in the same place. It makes the reader sort of pay attention and think about how these things relate to one another. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about having done that.
What's interesting is that there are actually a number, I'm seeing, in addition to those two sentences, right above the thing about cancer, that sentence, there's also a sentence that also is interrupted in a similar way with the only difference is that the parking garage and consultation room have now become liminal space, places of transition where time behaves differently, where the ending, if even a thing like an ending exists, is unknown, which is a set off in dashes as well.
Right.
And I think that's interesting. I think that's a really interesting observation, which I hadn't made specifically, but that definitely the way I think is, and this goes back to what I was saying about the way I work as well. So there'll be a thought process, and then the thought process interrupts itself briefly to either add something or not exactly correct something, but change the perspective, actually, is what I would say. The sentence begins, it interrupts itself, it changes perspective slightly, and then it continues. And in a way, that is exactly the effect, I believe, of a transition in a piece of writing as well. I mean, that's what it's doing is it is in some way stopping something, interrupting something, or opening something up in a way that makes the reader pay attention.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting because I think when we first learn about transitions in reading or writing, it tends to be taught that, you know, one thing leads naturally to the next, one thing leads neatly to the next. But in fact, sometimes it's so different from what came before that it's like this great pleasure. There's one in here. Let's see if I can find it really quickly. You had this. Yeah, you're on a trip you're on a train, a big snowstorm hits, and you have to get off the train, and you're taken by van to an okay but not great hotel, and you're thinking maybe you'd like to have a drink. And then, you know, you're looking around your room, and you find a book, a bookshelf filled with all kinds of different books, one of which is a volume of short stories. And one of the stories is called The Dream of Akinosuke. And you write, while he's dreaming, Akinosuke's soul emerges from his mouth in the form of a winged insect and leads him to the anthill where his wife's coffin is buried. If I wanted a drink, I was going to have to leave my room to find it. I loved that. So I laughed out loud. It was just so unexpected, that sentence coming after what you were looking at. And yet, as we think about it, I mean, it's like you weren't in the mood to read about that right then, you know?
Right. And I feel like I like that example very much, actually. It seems to me increasingly as I get older, when I'm writing, I am completely uninterested in what would be, I guess you'd call it transitional material, but the stuff you'd have to put in. So you have a character in a room and the character is going to get in their car. I do not want the part where they get up, they put on their coat, they open the door, they go down the stairs. I feel like, I mean, that's always kind of a bad idea to put all of that into a piece of writing, but whatever passes for that kind of material, I feel impatient with it. I feel like the most exciting thing happens with that sort of flight from idea to idea. And I know that's why I loved Time Passes into the Lighthouse. I mean, when I read that book, I thought I could not get over the fact that she had this whole section of the book where really nothing happens at all. And yet.
But time passes.
Yes.
This is a quote from the book, and I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about it. When someone you have lived with for a very long time dies, memory stops working its regular way. It goes crazy. It's no longer like remembering. It is more often like astral projection. That gave me pause. I thought a lot about it, and I wondered if you could just talk about it.
I think what I wanted to get across there is the way we tend to think of our memory as this reliable organ, this reliable there's a word I want here that I can't think of.
I liked organ.
Tool. It's like a tool. It's something we use all the time. And it's a reliable thing that functions in a way that sort of helps us keep our perspective in present time. There's always this big, huge bundle of past time that we're carrying around with us that's memory. And it's there, and we can, you know, reach in and get what we need so that we, you know where we put our shoes, or we see somebody and we remember the last time we, I mean, it's more often thought of in those terms. And then of course, when you're writing, memory is a different kind of tool. It's used in exciting ways to enhance the imaginative reach of a work of literature. It's also sometimes used horribly as just like a trip down memory lane, which is about as boring as it gets. When someone dies, what I realized is that your memories, which are, of course, I mean, that's one of the commonplaces. Someone you love dies and you are told well, you, but you've got your memories. You have your memories of the time. That's the consolation. And in a way, that's, of course, true. But what the memory itself has become dislodged from your present life with this person. The person isn't there anymore. It's not just like they went into a different room. And so the nature of the memory is, it is more like you're going to another planet or something. There's something, it settles down after a while, but the immediate response is something more like that. It's much more a mysterious exchange that occurs that, you know, you could explain in terms of, is the person still around? You know, if you consider different belief systems, like the Buddhist system says, well, the person can be around for a number of days in some form, and is not entirely gone from your life. Whether you believe that or not, there's some way something like that happens. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that intersects with the process of memory in a way that's very peculiar. Does that make sense?
It does, but I'm curious if it was, if you found it unpleasant or if it was just interesting.
It was more the latter. It was not unpleasant. It was like a discovery. And because at first it was hard to get what was going on, why I was experiencing memory that way.
This is me just patting myself on the back. I'm asking a question. I shouldn't ask this question because I actually wrote this question down. And then at the very end of the book, you say almost this exact thing. And I'm like, I'm so smart. But my question was, did you as a young woman conflate literature and romance or history and romance? And you certainly did. And then you say so at the end of the book. But I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about that, that kind of like obfuscation of art and life, I guess. Do you see that? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think because I was a book reader. I was a bookish young person. And this goes back to the Alexandria Quartet, mm-hmm. in a way. I mean, it was as if by reading the Alexandria Quartet, which to me was the pinnacle of a work of literature at the time when I read it, I could not have done any better. It was as if I was actually experiencing the romance, of which there was a lot in that book, without having the faintest clue whatsoever what was being talked about. And yet there was some way making that contact with Justine in the Alexandria Quartet, who I identified with strongly. just so when I think of it, it just makes me laugh. I mean, she was described, she was very, very glamorous. And I have never in my entire life been anything like glamorous. And yet somehow I could make this contact through my great identification with the character, with something that was separate from me.
Right.
And I feel like I still do that. Not in that same, adolescent way, but there's a way you get to make contact with something reading that bears a relationship to something that you desire in your life.
Right.
And then you see elements of the self, either by its absence from the connection you've made or by the fact that you actually do make some connection as you read.
Yeah, I was just looking for a quote. You write, as a child, you felt that these stories had their origin in you. And I thought that was great because it's a bit like what you were just saying. Maybe it is exactly what you were just saying. These aren't your stories, but you could so relate and you could just sort of feel like that you're responsible for it without having written it.
Well, with the fairy tales.
Yes, yes.
With the fairy tales, I really felt like, without putting it into these words exactly, I did feel like they were my stories, not like they had been written for me by Hans Christian Andersen. You know, like someone will say, that book was just written for me.
Right.
I just felt like they were mine. And everything about them, even the words in them that I didn't really understand, it felt like it came from me. Mm-hmm. In a really, when I think about it, profound way. I think it's why the connection I made with those stories when I was little was such a strong one. And it was because he was also talking about all the things that I was most deeply interested in, having to do with what it's like to live a life in time, which just always still just is such a kind of giant mystery and subject of fascination to me.
Right. Actually, this is a good point for me to mention that there's an article right now that's out from Lit Hub that explores your respect for time and your use of time in your work, and also your respect for Hans Christian Andersen's conjuring of the sense of time. So anyway, but let's talk about Elder Tree Mother, which is a chapter in your book, which is sort of talking about the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales. I loved your describing your experience of reading these tales, the details. I'm blown away by what you remember, by the way. I don't know, like, are you making some of this up? Because you have just extraordinary recall.
I have got, and I'm going to knock on wood here, I have a very good memory. I think just sort of like generally, not a very good memory if I was reading, I always remember this book, England in the 17th Century, that we had to read in high school, where I couldn't remember a word of it after I read it. But for the things from the past that have made a big difference, I do remember, and I remember little details. My sister does too. Like, we remember, you know, the names of everybody we went to kindergarten with and what they wore.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff is just extraordinarily vivid.
You have, in this one part of Elder Tree Mother, you start by remembering the smell of Vicks and Lipton noodle soup, and then you imagine, I think this is more of an imagined memory, your father approaching your bed, bringing you a gift and wondering if you're awake, and then you are, and he gives you this gift. And it's a set of books of the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales. And then you have this wonderful whole section where you imagine what might have happened to that set of books, because they eventually went the way of things and disappeared. But you go into a great, great riff on what might have happened to them. And then eventually your friend gives you that same box set when you're an adult, and you imagine it being maybe even the same set. So I loved that. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been the same set.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how specificity of memory or specificity of detail that's imagined or created can improve the engagement of story for a reader.
Oh, I just think it's kind of everything in a way. not to say that a work of literature has to be heavily laden with detail, but I think because of the way we're constructed as human beings, the way we make contact with kind of anything has to do, it's on many levels just sensory, like what you see, what you hear, what you feel, which is in large part the nature of detail. They're pieces of sensory information. And then out of that will emerge the more abstract things having to do with emotion or thought or the whole wider range of stuff you can't put your finger on exactly. Mm-hmm. But I think we require something concrete to get access to these other very exciting things. But if you just say, you know, hope, 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 there's nothing to hold on to. And I've talked about this with my students, that T.S. Eliot described a convention that he called the objective correlative, meaning if you want to talk about an intense emotion in a poem, you don't want to say, oh my God, I just felt so filled with love or horror or sorrow. You need some way to make that apprehendable to a reader. And the way you do that is by describing an object. It doesn't have to be a material object. It could be another person or something. But the way you describe this object is how you convey the fact that this feeling is present in the poem. And I think generally speaking, that works very well for a writer, and certainly for somebody reading. You're going to be much more interested in reading something where you yourself are experiencing the feeling. Right. And you get to do that in a way that if the writer just takes up all the room by saying, oh my God, I feel so great. Oh my God, I feel so sad. I mean, that doesn't do a thing.
No, you could talk about listening to music, or you could specifically mention the Columbia Record Club, which when you wrote that, I gasped and then I laughed out loud. I was like, I forgot about the Columbia Record
Club. Oh my God, the Columbia Record Club. And I actually, I didn't, there were things, there's, you know, there's material that I didn't put in this book that I feel like, I feel like I might want to write some more like this, because stuff I left out was just of great fascination to me, like remembering how I loved the Columbia Record Club so much that I, you know, joined it myself, which meant you were the person who had to let them know if you didn't want them to send you the selection. And if you forgot, you'd end up with some horrible record you didn't want. And they were impossible to send back. I mean, and it would just be, I don't want this. What am I going to do with it?
Right. It's like Blue Apron. If you forget, you're going to be on vacation.
Oh, it is. It's like Blue Apron.
Remember the Book of the Month Club, too, was the same, same style. Yeah.
Exactly.
We're winding down on our time. I have to figure out. I don't want to not ask you any of these
questions. This is a lot of fun.
It's always fun talking to you. Thank you.
I agree.
Let's see. Oh, this is, I want to talk about this. This has to do specifically with Eric. You write about, I'm not sure how much this was just a tossed out line or if this was a big important moment for you, but you write about encouraging Eric to haunt your home. Or at least mentioning it. And I wondered if you actually voiced that and how he reacted, yes. If so.
Yes. No, that's a real quotation from real life.
Yes.
And it was, I think, almost some of the things in the book are really quite accurate replications of moments in real life. Some of them are condensed or shifted in ways, but I had been telling him about these friends who had bought this really cute little row house in The Hague. And I was showing him the pictures and he just, you know, got sorrowful I'm trying to think of how it wasn't like he was plunged into self-pity. It was like reflective sorrow. Like, after everything I've done to this house, it's so sad to think I'm going to have to leave it. And I did just say, well, you could haunt it. And then, and he said, oh yeah, I could. And, because I don't think Eric himself had no experience with ghosts and hauntings, but I had, and he knew when I said that there was an element of belief in the fact that you could say, well, why don't you haunt the house? Here it is.
Yeah. Okay, great.
When I told our dentist visited Eric a bunch of times. They had become friendly through the work in the mouth. And when Dr. Koch heard that line, he just couldn't get over it.
Yeah. Well, it is unusual, but it sounds like you had a very unique and special relationship. And I think probably going through his dying together in the way that you did is hard, but probably a really good way to do it.
I hope the book in some way conveys the fact that it was not, I mean, I wish he hadn't died. That in a way goes without saying, but given the fact that was the hand we were dealt, I felt like it was just an extraordinary experience that we had together. Mm-hmm. And like nothing else, sort of the way you can't describe to somebody who hasn't had, you know, given birth to a child what childbirth is like. You can try, but you sort of can't explain. There's too much physical stuff and then emotional and psychic and spiritual. I mean, it's big. And I wanted in some way to convey with the book and the whole sort of array of things that I was talking about that are all part of, you know, who I became and how I became who I was going through this experience with Eric, that it was not horrible. It was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. This speaking of terrible transitions, this this is a question I always ask, but on the heels of that, I'm hesitant.
That's okay.
What have you read lately that you would recommend to listeners? I always ask that question. People like hearing about the books that the authors they like are reading.
The true answer is that because I'm right now in my teaching semester, mostly what I'm reading is the work my students are writing. Mm-hmm. And some of it is just mind-blowingly great, but
we can't get a hold of it.
Process, yeah. The last book I read that excited me was called Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont. And it's by Elizabeth Taylor, not that one.
That poor woman probably has to have that said every single time. Not that
one. She's no longer alive. She was an amazing writer. She brought the name confusion on herself by taking her married name. And I think it did not do her any great favors in terms of her, in terms of posterity, although she's being kind of rediscovered. The book Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont is now available with New York Review Books, that wonderful publisher who brings books back into print. And it's a remarkable book about, to say it's about getting older makes it sound like a younger reader might find it tedious, but no, it's about the mystery of life. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, and it's so gorgeously written. And I recommend it very highly.
Oh, great. Okay. That's wonderful. So one of the things I always think when I read your work is that I feel like people who want to read poetry but don't know how to read poetry could learn a lot from reading your prose, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
And I know that you were a poet, maybe before you wrote prose, right?
Yes.
I think I remember that. And maybe it has to do with concision as well. But anyway, I wondered if you have advice for writers or readers as they initially investigate poetry, or alternatively, experimental, non-linear, or unusual prose. I find your prose to be wonderful, and I don't mean to make it sound other in a bad way. It's just wonderful, but it's not, I wouldn't call it typical of anything. It's very unique to you.
Well, that's good, because that's what I want.
Good.
But I also don't want it to be, weirdo.
No, like, it's not. That's the thing. It's like, it's so relatable, and I'll be humming right along, and then all of a sudden something interesting happens, and I'm like, this is not like anything else I'm reading. That's what I would
that's
say.
That's good. Thank you. I do want that. Yeah. I think that the best advice ever I can give, as I give it to my students, is this is my advice, but it's sort of like there's the famous section. It's in Raise High the Roof Beam. It's in Salinger, where Seymour Glass is giving Buddy advice about writing. And he's basically saying, write what you want to read. Don't try to write something that you think is going to be admired in a particular way. Don't try to write something that is what you think literature is like. And even you wouldn't want to write something thinking, I want to write something a little experimental or different. I mean, that will be in you and it will affect what you write. But mostly, you should write what you want to read. The kind of thing you want to read. And then I also think it's very, very helpful if you have, as I am so lucky to have, I have a close friend who reads everything I write. And so I can think of her when I'm writing. I can think of also my agent is just a wonderful reader. And so there are a few people I think of very specifically, but not all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not just thinking, well, I wonder whether Jin's going to like this. but you want to be writing what you want to be writing. And it's harder to do. I mean, it sounds so obvious, but it's much harder to do than it sounds, because everybody's got these internal sensors saying, shouldn't this sound a little bit more like William Faulkner, or shouldn't this, this is never going to get published, or, What about my younger readership? Or, I mean, there's all this crap that gets in your head that you have to try to shut up to be writing what you want to write that comes out of you. That's the best thing to do.
Okay, fabulous. Thank you. I want to mention again, the name of the book is Aurelia, Aurelia by Catherine Davis. It's a memoir published by Grey Wolf Press. Catherine, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Sheila. I love talking with you. It's a great pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was a new interview with Vermont author Catherine Davis. You can learn more about her work at greywolfpress.org. Grey Wolf is her publisher. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Catherine Davis, who teaches a novel writing class, among others. In that class, she and her students have undertaken the exercise of writing a faux novel. Here's what it is. Without overthinking it, come up with a title and 10 chapter headings for an as-yet unplanned, non-existent novel. Then write one of the chapters, no more than 3 pages. You can keep it going if you want. Catherine says it's a great exercise, and in doing it alongside her students, she herself has come up with a lot of great material to use. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week. Often they're suggested by my guests, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Please be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.